Can't wait.
Can't wait. Can't wait.
Can't wait.
It was a good game. Both teams play hard.
With no regard for human life.
To all the non-believers, all we hear is about their defense. They can't stop a nosebleed.
I'm a man. I'm 40.
I got man hits like I was Rod Carew.
Yeah. Can't wait.
What happened offensively in that period?
Turnovers.
What about on the defensive end? They had their most productive quarter. What'd you see there?
Turnovers. Not two, not three, not four, not five, not six.
Not the game that I go out there and die for.
This is grown man B.I.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player.
Can't wait.
Can't wait.
Relax and take notes.
Hello and welcome to Can't Wait, KXCI's first, only, and by default, best sports and nonsense program. As always, I am joined by Matt Milner.
Hi, everybody.
We have Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
Hello.
And my name is Nick Provenis, and we have a red-hot show for you today. We are going to talk about the NFL draft, something we know very little about, but have a lot of opinions about, weirdly. We're going to get into a little bit of NBA playoffs talk, and then we might segue into some music video chatter, you know, the most red-hot form of media in music right now. We have a music video director with us, so he's going to be able to impart a little bit of wisdom that we might not otherwise get on a show like this.
That's right. I got all sorts of stuff to say about music video, even though I don't know that much about it. But I did produce one, and it's red hot.
It looks so good.
Thanks.
It looks good. Yeah.
And so right now, we're going to talk about the NFL draft. This is a multi-day, hours-long extravaganza that the NFL has commandeered a pretty healthy chunk of primetime television for what is more or less just a formality, just kind of a legal requirement to make. It's like you're just filling out your roster, really. It's not that exciting. But since the NFL is the most popular television show in the world,
right,
even their legal proceedings dominate primetime television. As such, we're going to discuss what it is like. Why is the NFL draft interesting or maybe not interesting, Matt?
Well, I love drafts in general, and I find the NFL draft to always be compelling each year. But I think part of it for me is maybe personally based, because my dad is one of the most obsessed NFL draftniks that I've ever met in my life. He every year produces his own big board and, like,
wow,
you know, identifies all his mid-round sleepers.
We should clarify for the audience. Your dad is Mel Kiper.
Yes, that's right. My dad is Mel Kiper.
Mel Kiper Senior. Weirdly.
Yeah, it's true. No, but so anyway, so there's a nostalgic part of the draft for me. But I will say that the fun part about all drafts, though not baseball, but we can talk about that as well, is the limitless potential that is in front of every team, that it's really the one day on the sports calendar when you have reason to be optimistic regardless of what team you're rooting for. And you can really bend yourself into contortions trying to justify why you should be hopeful after the horrible picks that your team made or how they managed to botch whatever situation they were in. But nonetheless, there's opportunity, there's hope, there's potential that just runs through that whole process.
It's the mystery grab bag, right?
Exactly.
It's the thing that we don't know. It's the potential of everything that's so tantalizing. Like, well, there's tons of studies that show that humans will gladly take the unknown over something that's stayed and true and very straightforward. We will always go for the unknown. It's why white elephant things exist, right?
Sure.
And why they have those gift parties. So, yeah, I mean, that's what's fun about the draft. It's got the playground sensibility of, I want you on this team, I don't want him on my team. And then even further, I mean, it goes back to video games for me too, because that was one of my favorite things in the NBA live games, mm-hmm, was getting to draft players. You know, I'd pick three friends and we'd draft our players and have tournaments against each other. I love that kind of contrived situation, and it's brilliant and lots of fun.
You know, the thing that's so captivating about any draft is it gives the audience a chance to feel like the expert. None of us know. You know, you can be a Mel Kiper or a Todd McShay and just be as strong in your opinion about some defensive tackle you've never seen play, but you're certain your team needs to take because of 12 seconds of video that you watched. So it's this opportunity that you get to feel like you know something. You know more than the GM does. You know more than the coach does. I have these very strong opinions, and there's no way to be proven wrong until a couple years at least down the line.
Right.
So it's kind of that ultimate armchair analysis day or series of days with the way that the NFL set up. So there are two players that everybody is required to have an opinion on. You have to have an opinion on Marcus Mariota versus Jameis Winston. The quarterback, obviously. Now, here's some NFL analysis you're only going to get here on Can't Wait. The quarterback is an important position on your football team. If you don't have a good quarterback, you're not going to go very far. So these quarterbacks, always at the top of the draft, command the most discussion. If you're a GM of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, you weren't very good last year. You're in this position for a reason. You have to nail this pick. So Winston, Mariota, Matt Milner, who are you taking?
Well, this year, I think, actually is one of the more interesting quarterback controversies that we've had in a little while, in part because there's been a consensus that crystallized pretty early on that Winston was the number one prospect in this draft. And the scouts have more or less been unanimous in agreeing that he's the best quarterback prospect to come along probably since Andrew Luck. But that he's certainly in the elite class of prospects for the past decade. Of course, Winston also has some of the most troubling off-the-field red flags that any elite prospect has had in quite some time.
We can call them horrifying.
They are horrifying. And you know, horrifying. We want to be careful to acknowledge that he has not been convicted of the crimes of which he has been accused. But nonetheless, there have been a number of both accusations and then also some confirmed things that happened too. I mean, nasty obscenities that he was suspended for during the season, and the shoplifting incident as well.
Extremely poor judgment given the circumstances surrounding him.
Exactly. And if the sexual assault allegations are true, then obviously that's as horrendous a crime as anybody can commit. So there's no question that the red flags are as red can be. And Mariota, on the other hand, is this guy who you could not put together a more sort of storybook quarterback when it comes to the intangibles. The way that he was able to lead his team, what people say about him on and off the field, good student, bright guy, all that. But, you know, the scouts all seem to be in agreement that Winston is the better prospect. The last little wrinkle to this before I finally reluctantly give an answer, I guess.
You get 15 minutes. That's 15 the minutes. Rule.
Yeah. So even though Winston is the consensus among the scouts, the analytics community, of which, you know, there's still less influence in the NFL than in some of the other major sports, but it's growing. The analytics community is very wary of Jameis Winston. If you look at some of his projections, they come up with a lot of the red flags that other notable top of the first round busts have had as well. And you know, the scouts obviously have a very different take on that. But the fact that there are those red flags in his statistical profile suggests that he may not be the sure thing lock that the scouts have suggested he is. Based on all of that, when you combine some of the statistical concerns with then the very, very serious off-the-field concerns, I think that the safer bet is to go with Mariota, who's a guy who I think you can feel confident is going to be able to start and play at a high level for 10 years, is going to be able to be a leader for the organization in the clubhouse, is going to be able to be a strong presence in the community. You're not going to have to worry about opening up the sports page and seeing him in there for the wrong reason. I think that I would lean towards Mariota.
You know, that's funny because Oregon quarterback and safe bet has not been in the same sentence when it comes to fielding an NFL team.
Sure.
They run, because the thing about college football, which separates it from college basketball, is it's able to be a separate sport, entertaining in its own right, that you don't always compare to the NFL. You're able to run different kinds of offenses. You're able to have different kinds of philosophies because in the NFL, a lot of that stuff that Oregon does just gets blown up by defensive ends who are 290 pounds and run the 40 in 4.6 seconds. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what Mariota's been able to do in college is predicated upon an offensive attack that is always going downhill, is always going at a pace that only Chip Kelly, you know, the former Oregon coach, has brought to the NFL with mixed results, up and down results. So when you see somebody like Mariota, who has not had to make traditional NFL plays in a traditional NFL offense, the thing about the NFL is it's very conservative within the general managers and the scouts. They go with what works in the past. To go with Mariota is to try to maybe guess at what the future of the league is going to look like, while Winston looks like somebody who's already succeeded before. He's this big, strong, strapping kid who you could, if you want to make a pro Winston argument, which, since this is a sports conversation show, I'm going to try to do.
Sure.
That is not a good Florida State team. The talent around him is not as good as you would think that Florida State could put forth. That was an average at best offense, and with an average quarterback, that's a 6-7 win team max. How many times did Jameis Winston lose in his college career?
One game.
One time.
Yeah.
That's incredible. He is, if you go value over replacement, Winston's number one by a mile. The only reason that that team was even anywhere near the national championship is based solely on his ability to make plays. He carried a larger burden for a pretty mediocre football team. And you would figure that with his size, his impossibility to sack, because he's weirdly athletic for somebody that doesn't look it necessarily, mm-hmm. big arm, somebody that just when he's on a football field has good judgment. Anything that happens outside the sidelines, that is, let's call it a cause for concern, just to be political.
Well, that's one of the fun's maybe the wrong word, yeah. But the most fascinating things about Winston is that there's a tendency, I think, probably a very unfair one, but a tendency to conflate the on-field judgment that players have with their overall intelligence or character or something like that. The idea that Peyton Manning is the field general and, you know, he's making all the right decisions on the field, but it's also because he's making the right decisions off the field to prepare and to exercise good judgment. And with Winston, there's no question that he is excellent at reading defenses and that
he is a spectacular football player.
Yeah, and very, very high football intelligence. There's no question about it. And that has not yet translated necessarily to his off-the-field judgment.
And he does so at a very early age. I mean, he was playing as a true freshman. Mm-hmm. He's not that old. And you're getting somebody, like if you were to use a basketball term, with a lot of upside. This is still somebody that has development to do, that has already shown the ability to win huge, high-pressure, high-level football games without necessarily a ton of help around him. So you would think that if you were to put him on an NFL team with an NFL coach that knows what he's doing, not necessarily that the Tampa Bay Bucks know what they're doing, but he feels like the kind of guy that you could put in for 12 years and say, be our quarterback. Mariota, on the other hand, has to adjust to a completely different style of play. I think he can do it. I really think Mariota is better than a lot of these spread the field, you know, spread option quarterbacks that maybe haven't translated immediately to NFL success. I see him more as a Cam Newton than a Johnny Manziel. Maybe not the physical profile of Cam Newton, but somebody that can make NFL-level throws, that 12-yard deep out that a lot of these smaller-armed spread formation quarterbacks really struggle with. So I think it's a good conversation to have. I think ultimately Winston's going to go number one.
Yeah, no question he will go number one.
I think Mariota ends up going two to either Tennessee. There's talk of the San Diego Chargers trading Phillip Rivers to get in that spot. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any way he could fall lower than like 3 or 4, right? I mean, there was talk of him falling number 6 to the Jets or even further beyond that. That seems like nonsense because I don't look at this draft with like an incompetent Sue or a Von Miller or, you know, one of those like offensive tackle, those Hall of Fame style guys that you would want to take 2 or 3 that you see in some of these other drafts. There's the defensive tackle out of USC, Leonard Williams, everybody seems to like. Is it Leonard Williams? Leonard Washington?
I thought it was Williams, but, you know, this is not a real professional operation
over
here.
The guy that's good?
Yeah, exactly. The guy that's good. The good defensive lineman from USC.
I like Amari Cooper because I've seen Alabama play.
Right.
I like Kevin White, the West Virginia wide receiver, because when I look at an NFL draft, I always like the really athletic wide receivers.
Right.
But ultimately, I don't see anybody here that makes me pass on Winston or Mariota at the top of the draft. And when I look at a draft, the next thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was, if you follow a football team, do you find yourself getting like weirdly attached to guys that you see in the mock draft, maybe within a 10-pick range of where you're picking, and you start to have these weirdly strong opinions about people you've never see play?
I think that's why people get obsessed with the draft, and you know, the phenomenon of the mock draft, and now the combines are aired in their entirety basically on the NFL Network, so you really can't sit there and watch offensive guards do the shuttle run for 4 hours out of your life, which I've done before, and I would really advise against it if you want to use your life well. There are good things to do in the world. That's not necessarily one of them. But in any event, yeah, I mean, you create these narratives about what does the future of your team look like with player X versus player Y, and you fall in love with one of those narratives, and you get your heart broken, you know, when it goes a different direction.
Or your guy trades down, or just any one of a million things happens on a draft. So when you're watching a draft, Rusty, what is it that typically goes through your head when your team is starting to pick?
I'm totally with you. I think that's what happens, is you get attached to guys, you get these narratives, and that's what I hear from you guys. I am not an NFL guy. I'm not an NFL draft guy. But even the conversation we're having about the two quarterbacks, I mean,
you start to have an opinion.
There's an opinion there, right? And my opinion, because I don't like the NFL that well, is that this guy sounds, I mean, the guy from Florida State, he sounds like a lot of football players. He sounds like people who are pampered and been told that they're great, and been told that they can get away with stuff that they shouldn't be getting away with, like walking out of grocery stores with all kinds of crab, or, you know, only football players, and only in Florida and Texas too at that, right?
Like, right, yeah.
Like, that's, Florida that guy is real. Yeah. And no offense, Matt, I know.
That's okay.
But they're a little crazy, and football makes them a little crazier, you know? And so you see that even now with just hearing you guys talk about it as sanely and rationally as you did, there's still this dialogue that we create that's not even true. It's completely fabricated for the most part. I mean, we really don't know anything about what this young man went through. We don't know if his accuser's real, you know. But we still talk about it, and we still do develop opinions. And certainly when the NBA draft rolls around, or if I'm drafting my fantasy team, I've got all kinds of opinions about, and that's where I play fantasy basketball, fantasy baseball. I loved the drafts. That's part of the reason I play. Mm-hmm.
I get mentally ill around the NBA draft. I don't have that strong of an opinion with the NFL because I just kind of look to see where the Denver Broncos are picking and who's going to be on my team this fall, who I have to start to get to know. Mm-hmm. The NBA draft, I turn into that mentally ill Jay Billis person who goes completely into every single prospect. I know the foreign guys. I know the second round foreign guys. I learn how to pronounce their names. This becomes a thing. And we'll get to that in July. Right now, I want to have kind of a larger scope conversation about drafts in general. What we haven't brought up about the draft is it's weird. It's weird that this is how these young men enter the workforce. No other industry would put up with this. So Matt, you're a fancy law talking guy, right?
That's me.
You went to school to talk law like a fancy law talker.
That's right, yes.
Lawyer. So if you come out of law school, let's say you're the Anthony Davis, Marcus Mariota of your law class. Mm-hmm. And
a common sentiment that I hear.
Yeah, that's kind of where you were, I'm guessing. So you come out, you're top of your class. Every law firm wants you. You've been offered whatever the agent equivalent in your profession would be. But you have to go, let's say, Duluth, Minnesota, to a law firm where two of the partners got arrested for insider trading, and it's just complete chaos, and you're there to save the law firm.
Right.
You're going to make a fixed amount. You're going to make the same that the guy last year made, whether or not you're any better or any worse, and that's your life for 4 years. If that's what the law industry was like, how would you feel about that?
Not so good, Al. Not so good.
It's crazy. Like, we accept that sports does not operate like life. Mm-hmm. It couldn't.
Right.
If every new employee into the workforce was allowed to pick where they live and what team they played for, they'd pick the same handful of teams. It doesn't necessarily mean that those teams would be good, because draft prospects bust out all the time for all sorts of reasons. They might not even necessarily gravitate to the same, like, let's say the number one pick in the NBA draft was a shooting guard 3 years ago, and would he go to the Lakers because he wouldn't get to play ahead of Kobe? So I don't know how it would shake out. I just always like to think about what that would be like if Jameis Winston was a free agent entering the league and Jerry Jones got to pay him whatever he wanted to pay him to go play for the Dallas Cowboys. Is that a better or worse system than what we have now?
Well, I would say that, you know, the whole sense of entitlement, and it would be worse. It would be worse. I mean, as much as you see the NFL in trouble now, think how much worse it would be if these guys coming out of college were filled with as much money as they, if somebody wanted to throw at them. And again, you're talking about Texas. So they're going to go and they're going to live in, you know, in a society that's going to build around them, right? I mean, I remember in Oklahoma, right? I mean, in Oklahoma, that college, who was the coach there that was there for so long who...
Are you talking Switzer?
Yeah, Barry Switzer, yeah. Right? Like the whole environment he created there. I mean, he had the police on his payroll. I mean, not exactly, he didn't pay anybody. But gosh, the police went, if his guys got in trouble, they went to him before they went to anybody else, before they talked to the player. How does that happen in life? And it would get worse if we did give these guys all that kind of, it's already bad. I think it's really, and we really do, we create these narratives again of people we don't really know. We do it all the time with people in the limelight. But I think it would be worse, but this is America. It's interesting. Everybody always says communism and socialism doesn't work because it doesn't take into account human behavior. And well, laissez-faire capitalism doesn't take into account human behavior and human greed. It's the same thing. It's got the same problems in that it doesn't take into account how we act as a people if everybody starts throwing everything we want at us, you know? I think it would make for a worse culture.
The other thing is that ultimately with sports, there's this balancing act that's always performed about whether we want pro sports to be a meritocracy or whether we want to support parity. Because if your goal is that you just want the best teams to be as good as possible in the biggest markets where they're going to have as much money and be able to support that product, then the current system works against that because it prevents those big market teams from being able to use that clout to the extent that they would be able to otherwise. And kind of the alternative is you look at something like the English Premier League, where you've had literally a handful, like you can count on one hand the number of teams that have finished at the top of the Premier League, you know, over the past several decades, because the system is set up in such a way that there's not that forced parity of the draft and free agency in the way that it exists in American sports.
Yeah, transfer fees, and it's a whole thing.
It's a different thing, but the draft is a big part of it because it means that the elite prospects, they're signed to Manchester United's academy when they're 13 years old for buckets of money, and you know, there's an opportunity for some of the smaller clubs to be able to get elite prospects as well. By the time they turn 17 or 18, again, the dump truck of money comes and they get transferred to the big clubs. So that's a different model than the American sports. And even though the draft, it does have some troubling elements to it sometimes, I ultimately do like that it has that leveling effect and that it does result in the bottom being pulled up a little bit. And for every fan base in the NFL or the NBA, as the case may be, there is still that hope that the great prospect is around the corner. They're going to fall to you in the draft and it's going to change your fortunes, even if you're not in a market where you would be able to attract that kind of elite talent if it was a truly level playing field.
And the NFL is set up for parity more so than any sports league Absolutely. We've ever seen. And the goal is for every team to be 8-8 with the smarter teams and the smarter coaches and health basically working out who's going to be your Super Bowl champion. So in a league like the NFL, the draft really works based on its already established ethos. The NFL, you don't really have the same tanking that you would see in a league like the NBA, where you can go on these like multi-year teardowns to try to increase your odds at landing one or two franchise players. Because in the NFL, I mean, that's a 53-man roster. The quarterback is obviously the most important thing. But in order to have a functional, sustainable, Patriots-like run where you can be good for a while, you have to be able to be solid drafting rounds 2 through 7, your minor free agent moves, not just your here's $60 million guaranteed to sue, here's all the moves we make. It's such a more complicated thing, and the draft is only one part of it. Whereas in something like the NBA, the draft leads to these scenarios like you see with the Philadelphia 76ers and a handful of other teams who are intentionally bad for a very long time with no real plan to get better other than shrugging your shoulders and hoping maybe to get lucky. So I like the NFL draft based upon what they have established their league to be. I am open to all sorts of suggestions with the NBA. Mm-hmm. And what you see with their new Players Union Director, Michelle Roberts, they're ready to shake things up too.
Yeah.
And as we talk about the NBA, one of our very own, Stanley Johnson, is going to be entering that draft pool here soon. So one and done, had a good, would you call it a disappointing freshman year? Because I wouldn't. I thought he was actually pretty good, but what we were promised was Justice Winslow and what he was at Duke. I think Stanley Johnson played the last 3 weeks of the season with minor injuries that may have impacted where draft people view him. I think once the combine hits and once he gets to show how athletic he is, I think he might end up going somewhere as high as 5, but no lower than 9. So do you think it was a good decision for him to come out after 1 year, Matt Milner?
I think it absolutely was. I don't see any scenario in which he comes back next year and noticeably improves his stock, because as you said, he's already in that mid to late lottery window, and I think that he can control based on workouts and how he performs in his one-on-ones with these teams. He can improve that stock, you know, so that he moves into that 7-8 range. And I think if he comes back next year, he has to be the national player of the year to be able to appreciably move higher than that. And one of the advantages that Stanley Johnson has is that he's so young. He's just turning 19 in May. So he's going to play his entire rookie season in the NBA as a 19-year-old. And that has a lot of value for NBA teams as they're trying to project out going forward about what this guy will turn into.
So when you looked at his freshman season, Rusty, what was your thoughts of Stanley Johnson's game?
Well, I'll tell you, I thought he came in, like you were saying, with lofty expectations that probably could never be met. He ended up scoring 13 points a game, 6 rebounds a game, over almost 7. I mean, that's a very successful freshman college basketball player.
Yeah, he was the no-question Pac-12 freshman of the year.
Yeah, and his team went to the Elite Eight. He did have the little nagging injuries that probably held us back a little bit. I don't know that we ever beat Wisconsin,
right?
You know, on that night they were shooting lights out. You couldn't have stopped them. So Stanley Johnson had a as good as a one and done career as you're going to have in college. That's what you expect almost. It was a little underwhelming, I guess, if you expected all world. But he's still going to be one of the top 10 players. He's got to go in the draft, right? You'd be a dummy. Your job is to make money. Your job is to do your job and make money doing it. Well, that's what he's doing. And to me, that's what you have to do then, is go out. You have to take advantage of the rules as they are. He shouldn't have had to go to college.
Absolutely. Because unlike a lot of other very young freshmen, he is an NBA-ready physical specimen.
Mm-hmm.
His body type is such that he can withstand maybe not 82 games of it. I think that's going to be an interesting thing we see in his rookie year, how he holds up over the full sled. But he is so physically built, he is so strong, that it's going to be really fascinating to see if his game translates to a league where he doesn't bully, you know, comparable players at his position, where he can just match up physically. I feel like his NBA ceiling, I feel like at the very worst, he ends up being a solid starter. But I think that as his body fills out, because he's already this big at 19, I think his game is going to resemble Paul Millsap's of the Atlanta Hawks. Mm. And I think he's going to be kind of a hybrid small forward, power forward kind of guy. Right now he's a small forward. But I think as the league kind of goes to this pace and space model, I think he can play some small ball four. Mm-hmm. I think he can defend both positions pretty credibly. He's pretty long for 6'7", 6'8". He's got enough range. He showed three-point range mm-hmm. his freshman year, at least at the college three. If he can extend that out to the corners and maybe even hit open threes in the flow of an offense, his ceiling could be that of a Paul Millsap or, at the worst, like a Jeff Green. You know, these kind of rangier, bigger wings. I hesitate to throw around Kawhi because I think Kawhi is once in a generation.
Yeah.
And that there are always these players in the NBA that end up making a lot of other players a lot of money based on physical comparable attributes. For a while, everybody that kind of was built like Tyson Chandler after the Mavericks won the title, all those guys were making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why you saw like Sam Dallenberg keep cashing checks. That's why Larry Sanders got all that money right away.
Oh, heck yeah.
So I think that Kawhi Leonard and Jimmy Butler are going to lead to some very high draft positions for Justice Winslow and Stanley Johnson and big free agent contracts for guys like Damari Carroll. Mm-hmm. So Stanley Johnson's coming into the league at a very good time for his skill set.
I agree. And I think that, that's going to be an important part of his development trajectory is, first of all, is he able to develop the level of defensive consistency that you see from those guys? Because that was, to me, one of the more disappointing parts of his year. And admittedly, with freshmen, there's always going to be some issues on team defense because they're just not used to having to play that high-level team defense and having to get used to those principles. And certainly by every indication, Stanley Johnson is an incredibly hard worker and is a gym rat. And you know, you don't worry about him resting on his laurels and not trying to improve his game. But that being said, there were definite lapses in defense, both in team defense and individual defense. He does not have elite foot speed and lateral quickness. He's not one of those guys who you can just put him in front of any perimeter player and you know that he'll be able to at least stay in front of him. His wingspan, I think, is good, but not elite. Not, you know, Kawhi Leonard, who has an insane, you know, like 7'3 wingspan.
Right.
With, you know, 12-foot-long hands. But you know, I think those are issues. And also, my biggest concern with him on the offensive end is how much he struggled to finish at the basket for a guy who seemed to have such a great athletic profile. You know, and I don't know what his actual vertical leap off of, you know, 1 foot and 2 feet, would be if you measured it. But he didn't seem to have the vertical explosiveness that you might expect for a player who's so physically built. So I do worry a little bit that when he's consistently going up against bigger defenders who are experienced and savvy, that he's going to struggle even more to finish. And that's a tough path for a big wing if you're not a threat to be able to drive to the basket.
Well, and that was part of what you're talking about, is if things don't go his way, that's when he did kind of take a play off, you know, and maybe that's just him being 19, but that could be more. That could be a character issue, and if you go to the NBA, there's nobody. I mean, people are willing to help you, obviously, and you've got veterans that you can lean on, but at the same time, it's a man's game, and you've got to have it. You've got to have your head together. If you don't, you're going to fall apart, and you're not going to make it in the NBA.
The NBA right now exists at two depths, 6 inches in front of the rim, and 23 feet from the hoop.
Right.
If you can't succeed in either of those places, it's hard to carve out a niche. You have to be a Tony Allen-level bulldog defender. You have to be a blur with the basketball. I mean, you have to be like Isaiah Thomas with the basketball. If you're not hitting threes and you can't convert at the rim, it's really hard to carve out a niche. I think Stanley Johnson's niche ultimately is going to be that small ball four who can kind of do a lot of things and hopefully get better at finishing at the rim, which is why I think ultimately he's going to get drafted 7th. That's going to be the number, I think. I feel good about 7. Mm-hmm. You look at the history of the NBA draft, 7's kind of a hit or miss proposition. That the guy that goes there has a lot of attributes that you love, but maybe one or two fatal things that keep him from being one of those top three or four picks that can be a foundational member of your team going forward. But what I do know is that Can't Wait is going to be your number one pick when you're here at kxci.org listening to Sports and Talk. We'll be back for the next segment right after this.